One, two, three, four.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now in the studio is Marcy Newman, a teacher, writer, and activist who for the past 6 years has been living and teaching in Palestine, Jordan, and Lebanon. She's the co-founder of the Nahel Bared Relief Campaign and the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and is the author of The Politics of Teaching Palestine to Americans, the proceeds of which are donated to the Middle East Children's Alliance. And also joining us is Anthony Lowenstein, who's an independent Australian journalist, activist, and blogger. He's the author of two books, My Israel Question and The Blogging Revolution, and co-editor of Left Turn. He has written for The Guardian, The Nation, Huffington Post, Haaretz, and other publications. Welcome to Background Briefing to both of you, Marcy Newman and Anthony Lowenstein.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And let me begin with Marcy. In terms of the event tonight that you all appearing at, what happened after Zionism, I take it that the theme is that the two-state solution is dead and that the only way to proceed is a one-state solution. So why would you assume that the Israelis government would be more receptive to a one-state solution than they've been to a two-state solution?
I think that the evening's event is sort of situated around Anthony's book and the questions he raises, so I think that would be better addressed to him. For me, my work is about educating people about Palestine in order to elicit an end to Zionism.
Well, let me ask you that question, Anthony, since it's obviously better directed at you.
Sure. I think in many ways one of the reasons behind the book was to say that so much of the public debate about Israel-Palestine revolves around the question of if only the two sides, Israel and Palestine, got together, they sat down in a room, some kind of equitable peace could be brought, a two-state solution, a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. And there's no doubt that anyone who spends any time in Palestine will realize that the intention of Oslo, the peace accords that were signed roughly 20 years ago, was in fact the opposite of that. It was to enrich and enlarge and allow the Israeli occupation to continue. You ask in your question, how likely is Israel to accept a one-state solution? The short answer is right now, they're absolutely not. They're opposed to it implacably, because clearly a one-state solution would mean probably a minority Jewish state. This is not question of a belief that should be imposed by force, nothing like that. It's to say that in a modern world, a discussion about what a one-state solution would look like needs to be addressed, because we're getting to the point where, on the ground, a two-state solution is never going to happen. But in terms of the public debate, we're getting to the stage where more and more people are realizing that any kind of equitable sharing of land, a viable Palestinian state, simply is impossible. And therefore, a democratic secular state with both peoples and all the issues that entails, and we talk about that in the book, should be discussed now when that conversation begins in a much more major way in the public in the next years.
And Marcy Newman, what's your sense of the current state of the Palestinian question? Because it seems to me that what Prime Minister Netanyahu has managed to do is, because he keeps talking about Iran all the time, he's managed to successfully shift the focus to Iran and make the Palestinians again invisible. And I think it's a deliberate tactic on his part, because he doesn't really have a solution. And he says he wants peace, but he doesn't really ever get to talk about it. They talk about talking about peace, but they don't actually. So we have a process, a peace process, but we don't have peace. And that's been going on for some time. So in terms of the kind of decade-long fraud, if you will, where do we stand today?
I mean, for where I live in Lebanon, this is not how things are framed, and this is not how the media portrays things. And so it's, in fact, Palestinians are not invisible in the media where I live. So I think that for me, in terms of what I'm consuming and what I'm seeing on TV and in the newspapers, It's very much about Palestinians who have been in the streets, both protesting the Palestinian authorities, complicity and collusion with the Israeli regime and the way that it is basically enforcing Israeli policies in the West Bank, about what's happening in Gaza with the ongoing assault on Gaza that has never ended. So this is sort of what I see and what I hear on a daily basis. So I'm not really subjected to a lot of the things that I think people are subjected to here in terms of the media. But I would also add that you know, locally in Los Angeles, you know, yesterday and also last week, I participated with Dump Veolia Los Angeles in speaking at City Hall against the new Veolia contract with the Los Angeles with the municipal bus system. And we had 33 people speaking with us on that day. And there were only 4 people from the Jewish Federation of Los Angeles and from Veolia Corporation who were speaking against it. I mean, for me, that suggests that things are shifting in some ways, that things are progressing and that people are waking up to what's right and what's wrong, what's moral and what's not.
But Anthony, surely the assumption's always been that the United States is the 900-pound gorilla in the room, isn't it? That they're supposed to be the ones that are going to broker a peace if there's ever to be a peace. And that I assume, is why Israel has so successfully influenced American politics. So what's your sense of what it's going to take to change opinions in America about getting serious about a solution, whether it's a two-state or a one-state, but, you know, something?
Yeah, look, there's no doubt, as you rightly say, that the American position for 20 years, in fact, really, frankly, since the establishment of Israel, with a few exceptions here and there, has been uncritically supportive of Israel. The occupation in the West Bank, which now has roughly 700,000 Jewish settlers living there illegally, could only have happened with the support and funding and defense of the U.S. and indeed my country, Australia, and many other Western states as well. What I think, and Marcy is correct on this, there is at the moment a bit of a disconnect between often public opinion and certainly a surge in discussion about the issue and the political reality. In the U.S. Congress, anyone who knows this issue will say, it's almost like the only way you can get far in your career in this country, whether you're Republican or Democrat, is to be blindly pro-Israel. But in public opinion and public discussion, there is a shift going on. How that's going to be reflected in kind of political policy is yet to be seen. But certainly in many other countries around the world, much of Europe, parts of the UK, parts of Australia and elsewhere, there has been a growing awareness that by remaining silent about what Israel is doing, in fact, the great irony, and this is one thing I say this as a Jewish person myself, that by Israeli actions, blind support from the US or any other country, in fact, is killing the chance of Israel actually existing as any kind of independent entity. I mean, continued colonization can only continue. The only way it can continue indefinitely is essentially continuing to colonize Palestinian land, which means that a Jewish state, which is a Jewish majority state, which is what Zionists and Israel and the US says should happen, is actually going to be impossible simply on demographic reality, where in the next, we don't know when, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, soon, there's going to be a minority Jewish population in both Palestine and Israel. So the short-term thinking about this, I think, is why these discussions like tonight, and I've been doing a book tour for the book in Israel, Palestine, the UK, and now the US, is important, because unless we talk about what's going to happen next, we're going to be pretty unprepared for the reality.
So, Marcy Newman, at the Democratic Convention, of course, we all witnessed the roll call by Mayor Villaraigosa to change some of the platform to include God and also to include the capital of Israel as Jerusalem. And I think most fair-minded people watching that recognized that they didn't get a two-thirds affirmative. The nays actually were at least as loud as the yeas. And also now, of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu has argued that he's not getting involved in the U.S. elections, which he clearly is. His biggest supporter is Sheldon Adelson. He's the biggest donor so far to Mitt Romney. And now we learn that a front group called Secure America Now, which is run by a group of neoconservatives, are buying a lot of ad time in Florida to influence the Jewish vote down there in favor of Romney against Obama. So what's your sense of where we stand in terms of what was indicated in what was indicated at the Democratic Convention was that blind support, as Anthony just said, for Israel is perhaps on the wane?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think, you know, one thing for our mayor here in Los Angeles that he should be reminded of is Los Angeles was one of the first U.S. cities to divest from South Africa under apartheid. And so I think that, especially with the Veolia campaign here.
By the way, you've mentioned that before, and just give us a quick sketch of what that is, because I'm not up on that.
Veolia is a French company that has built a Jewish-only rail system that connects Jerusalem to settlements in the West Bank. And so there are many cities in Europe that have boycotted Veolia, including two French cities. And so we have a campaign here in Los Angeles to get rid of contracts with Veolia as a result of that. So there is a precedent in Los Angeles, which our mayor should be conscious of going with the moral position. SB 1070 in Arizona, we were one of the first cities to be on board with the boycott of Arizona. So, I mean, I think we need to do a better job of connecting these issues for Los Angelinos and our government here to make sure that they can be on the right side of history again.
And Anthony, given that you're from Australia, and Australia, I suppose, has followed pretty much politically the same path as the United States, in the sense that their politicians tend to favor the Israeli position over the Palestinian position, and I don't know whether that's as a result of an equivalent in Australia to APAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, which is the big lobby here. I'm not up on Australian politics, whether they have a similar lobby. But what we did recently see from Australia, which was quite surprising, if not alarming, was demonstrations where Arab Australians were demonstrating in the streets against this movie that nobody's ever seen. And they were shouting in the streets, "Obama, Obama, we love Osama." So tell me about what's going on in Australia.
Yes. Well, I've been overseas for the last 6 weeks, but having said that, I certainly followed what was happening. There's no doubt that there were recently, a few weeks ago, a couple of, like you have in a lot of countries, a very fringe group of Muslims who express views that most other people don't like, they don't accept. I mean, we have in Australia, unlike in the US, where you have the right to free speech, here in Australia we haven't got that. And yet those people sometimes, I don't exactly know if they've been arrested, I don't think they have. But as I said, in terms of Australia's foreign policy and Australia's position in terms of the Middle East in general, we have a multicultural country. There obviously are problems with that in terms of certain groups have had more issues integrating. But more importantly, there's a sense that there's undoubtedly racism in Australia at the moment. The greatest group, I would say, that fuels intimidation and racism is definitely the Muslim community, particularly since September 11th, quite like a lot of other countries around the world, including here in the US. Foreign policy towards Israel-Palestine, you're right, is really very much following the US line. Australia's foreign policy arguably is decided in Washington, not in Canberra, our capital. We have an equivalent lobby to APAC. It's called AJAC. It's not directly related to APAC, but it's certainly the same mentality. I think in some ways also Australia's identity is rather confused. So on the one hand, we saw ourselves, Australia saw itself very much as part of Europe many years ago, part of the British Empire, and now, of course, its identity being part of the Pacific and part of Asia is very different. The makeup of Australia was radically shifted in the last 20, 30 years to be far more Asian and Middle Eastern. So in some ways, I think our foreign policy has not put up to that. So we still follow blindly the U.S. line on Israel-Palestine. We were in Iraq and Afghanistan with the Americans. It's pretty much, if there was an attack, and we all hope there's not, on Iran from Israel or the U.S., Australia inevitably would support that. So there is very much a challenge in Australia, and there's certainly a vocal and growing minority of individuals who are advocating for that. And finally, unlike the U.S., in Australia you've seen in the last 10 years in public opinion a profound shift in support for the Palestinian cause. Whereas years ago, most Australians, like indeed most Europeans, many years ago at least, supported the Israeli position. These days, that's changed. So America really is quite isolated in terms of public opinion. Again, obviously, there are many Americans who don't support Israel, but in terms of the mainstream public opinion polls, Australia is following very much other parts of the world, and that I think concerns many Israel lobbyists in my country.
Well, just in the last few minutes, let me begin with Marcy Newman and talk about what you're going to be talking about tonight, what happens after Zionism.
I'm going to be talking about how we get there, which means educating Americans and especially Los Angelinos about Palestine and as a means to disrupt Zionism or get beyond Zionism.
And Anthony, obviously you're going to be talking about your new anthology, After Zionism, One State for Israel and Palestine. Tell me what you're going to be presenting tonight.
Yeah, well, I'll be talking a little bit about the book, but it's not going to be a shameless spruiking alone. It's also, I think, going to be a discussion about how I think public opinion is shifting and kind of the reflections I've had on the book tour I've had so far in terms of the response in Palestine, Israel itself, which clearly is a central point in terms of moving this debate forward. And I think also articulating the ways in which what a one-state solution might look like. I think often when people hear that idea, they say, well, it sounds great in theory, but what does it actually mean? And the book provides a number of essays by Palestinians, by Jews, by others, to articulate what a democratic state would look like and why increasing numbers of Palestinians and a small number of Israelis, but that is shifting, do believe that a democratic one state, in fact, is the only way forward. So how do we get there, basically?
Well, just in closing, though, Marcy, the title of the talk is What Happens After Zionism, where does the assumption come that Zionism is over?
Again, that's not me. That's Anthony's book. But, I mean, because I don't see its demise yet. I look forward to that day, but I don't, see it on the horizon.
Let me ask Anthony then. Why do you assume that there's a post-Zionism about to happen?
We don't think in the book, and no one is arguing that Zionism is about to end tomorrow. It's more, in some ways, it's supposed to be, A, a provocative title, but B, imagining the fact that growing numbers of both Jews in America and elsewhere, that the image of Zionism in Israel globally has never been worse. So therefore, we think it's vital to have a conversation about the destructive nature of what Zionism has done, both to the Palestinians, but also to the Jewish community, both here and Jews in general, that it's allowed discrimination to be almost accepted under the guise of the protection of a Jewish state. So we think it's important to talk, and I say this, as I said, as a Jew, and many other Jews and non-Jews argue this as well, Zionism itself is the problem here. So it's not about to end tomorrow, but let's try and imagine a world in which that Jews can live safely, that goes without saying, but in a way that doesn't discriminate against Palestinians in the process.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Anthony Lowenstein, again, an independent Australian journalist, activist and blogger. He's the author of the new anthology, After Zionism, One State for Israel and Palestine, and also The Israel Question and The Blogging Revolution. And he's the co-editor of Left Turn, and he's written for The Guardian, The Nation, Huffington Post, Haaretz, and other prominent publications. And also joining me in studio is Marcy Newman, a teacher, writer, and activist who for the past 6 years has been living and teaching in Palestine, Jordan, and Lebanon. She's the co-founder of the Nar El Barad Relief Campaign and the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, and is the author of The Politics of Teaching Palestine to Americans, the proceeds of which are donated to the Middle East Children's Alliance. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the discussion continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out.
disappeared by happiness.